From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, schools began Monday throughout California, and since July, San Francisco has had a new school superintendent. Carlos Garcia joins us for a wide-ranging discussion all about San Francisco schools and the budgetary challenges and growing achievement gap, violence prevention, schools closing down, and what to do about racial integration. Forum is next with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. On July 16th, Carlos Garcia took over the San Francisco school superintendent's job from interim superintendent Gwen Chan. And over the past weekend, he helped bring about a settlement in the teacher's contract. And he's pledged closing the growing achievement gap between white and Asian students and their black and Latino counterparts. A former Mission District middle school principal at Horace Mann, Carlos Garcia also ran the Las Vegas County School District in Clark County, the fifth largest school district in the nation. He spent 6 years as superintendent in the Fresno School District. Presently, with 140 schools and some 55,000 students, San Francisco has had a surge in kindergarten enrollment after years of decline. San Francisco also has the highest percentage of children in public schools in the state, and test scores have been on the rise in San Francisco schools, the highest average of any urban district in the state. Nevertheless, there are problems and challenges certainly that face Carlos Garcia and those who have children in the schools in San Francisco, and he joins us for this forum hour, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you. First day jitters are over, and you're right in, but you're still in your honeymoon phase, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's great. I hope it keeps going.
Well, let's hope so. You've talked about how you believe San Francisco is trying to do too much, so that brings in the whole question of what ought to be the triage of priorities. And I guess right away, since certainly you've talked about it and addressed it, we're talking about the achievement gap.
Oh, absolutely. I just think that our district doesn't have the resources to do everything it wants to do, but it would have the resources to do some specific things that need to be done, such as closing the achievement gap.
Well, you said you want to do that in 5 years. Give us just a sense of how that can be done.
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways of doing it. I just think you just can't continue to do what we've always done and expect it to change, because it's not going to change. People have done some, they've really worked hard. They've tried to do things. But the type of teaching, the instruction that we're using is not being effective with the type of clients that we have in front of us in the classroom. So we're going to have to reexamine how it is that kids learn. We know that African Americans and Latino kids are certain types of learners, and we're going to have to address our pedagogy, the way we teach in the classroom, to their learning styles. And that's something that, there's been a lot of data and a lot of literature written on since the 1970s, and yet if you go to American schools across this country, you don't see that in practice.
Well, you have a couple of retreats slated for September. Pedagogy is going to be on the top as far as determining what your goals are going to be?
Well, I think one of the things that really what we want to do is narrow down what specific goals we need to address. Instead of having 20 different, every month at a board meeting, a new goal could appear if we're not careful, because we're trying to do so much and we're so conscientious. We have a board that wants to address all the issues, and rightfully so. I don't blame them. But we don't necessarily, we keep diluting our resources when we're trying to do so much. And instead of let's concentrate, let's get something done that we can measure, that we could show progress on. And once we finish that, then let's take on something else. But it's impossible for any system to try to take on all the different issues that San Francisco is trying to do.
We're talking with Carlos Garcia, superintendent of San Francisco's Unified School District, and there have been major cuts in your administrative staff. Some would say that's perhaps a good thing, but there's less spent on administrative staff in San Francisco. And I'm wondering if this is a problem as you see it and what you can do about it.
Well, it is a problem. When cuts come, it seems that all these folks here are good soldiers here at the district office, and they're good martyrs, so they want to take the hit. You can take the hit for so long, but after a while, the infrastructure doesn't exist to support what's going on the schools. And that's especially critical if your curriculum and instruction support networks are no longer there. This district used to have some incredible resources for instruction and curriculum, and most of those have been depleted because of cuts over the years. And so I'm not talking about just the people who work in the district office. I'm really talking about the people who are out there to support teachers and make sure that we have the best types of programs that can be used in the classroom to make students successful.
What about the dropping enrollments? You came from Las Vegas, where enrollments were surging, and in San Francisco, despite the fact that, as I mentioned in my introduction, kindergarten numbers are up in enrollment, there's been this ongoing, some call it retreat, high cost of housing, children in private schools, so all kinds of reasons behind it, but nevertheless, dropping enrollment.
Yeah, that's a big challenge for us, and it is. It's so multifaceted in the sense that housing is something that's really expensive, but what can you do when you just keep one of the things is the housing issue, but I also think that we need to take some responsibility for it, and that is to create some schools that are very dynamic. If we know that people are leaving us and yet we have waiting lists to go to certain schools and not enough of the people get into the first choices of where they want to go, then in some ways we're encouraging people to leave us. So what we need to do is make sure that we create more schools like the ones that have huge waiting lists so that people can go there. And if we created more of those and people, you know, I think we'd retain a lot more people in the district if we would just be able to do that. And that's something that we're going to have to do. If not, then we deserve a loss.
Haven't the schools that have been closing down been largely Black and Latino population schools?
Largely so, yes. And the way in which we close down schools is something that we're going to have to reexamine. I believe that if we're going to consolidate our resources or close schools, then we ought to be doing it so that we create better schools. In other words, if I ever get to the point where I'm going to propose closing some schools down, then before I even talk about that, I'm going to talk about what program is going to exist in the school that students are going to go to. And it can't be the same old type of program. It has to be a very dynamic program, such as, you know, we have our technology here in this district is way behind the time. So maybe we need some schools that offer a different type of technology. We don't have to replicate every single school. We could actually create, out of one big school, create a bunch of small schools within a large school that are independent schools. I think with enrichment programs, with community-based organizations involved in them, I think we could do those types of things instead of, you know, from what I've seen, we've consolidated some schools, but what we've done is we haven't done anything different in the schools. Once we created this new school, instead of, you know, having a school that every parent could walk in and have that wow effect where they walk in and say, wow, maybe it wasn't so bad that they consolidated my school. Look at what they came up with. This is exciting. My child will want to be there. If we're going to do this, then we're going to do it right, because I really believe that we're just too poor to be cheap. So if we're going to do things, let's do them world class.
How does integration figure into that?
Well, I think integration, it's funny because with the new Supreme Court ruling, which personally I disagree with, but it's the law, I think that, you know, we're going to have to address this a little bit more creatively. And I think the best way to address integration is to create dynamic programs that everybody wants their child in. You know, I think back when I was at Horace Mann, we didn't really have a lot of problems drawing people. By the time I had left, you know, here we are in the heart of the Mission District, a school that wasn't supposed to be successful. But by the time we left, we had a waiting list of several thousand parents who wanted their children there. And parents from, you know, affluent schools, private schools, from the so-called better schools, they were knocking down our door to get kids in there. Why? Because we had an excellent program. And I believe that if you build programs that are excellent, people will be knocking down your door. And therefore, it desegregates itself because everybody wants their child to be at the best program.
We're talking with school superintendent of San Francisco Unified School District, Carlos Garcia, who's with us by phone this morning. And he officially became superintendent in July. Maybe we could talk a little bit about what brought you here, because I know that when you were in Las Vegas, you thought, boy, this is the dream job, and I'm going to stay here until I retire, and then wound up leaving there, and as I understand it, going to McGraw-Hill for a while, even leaving school administrative jobs, period, and then wending your way or moving your way or however we want to phrase it in terms of the verb back here. What brought you back here?
Well, I think, you know, as you say, I was in Clark County for 5 years. When I finished there, I'd been in education for 30 years. I guess I'm getting old. And after 30 years of service, I decided, you know, in 30 years, I've never had a sabbatical, a time to just reflect and get away and think about things. McGraw-Hill Corporation approached me and asked me to be a vice president for them. And I thought, well, you know, I'm young enough to try that, and if it doesn't work out, then there'd be no hard feelings. I'd want to get back. Well, I did it, and I enjoyed it. I got to have input on, you know, what type of programs they ought to develop for the future for non-English speaking students that are learning English. I got an opportunity to see some of the best things out there all over the country and all over the world of what works for kids. And after spending 2 years of doing that, I realized, well, what good is it to know all this information of what really works and what's out there, and from all companies, not just McGraw-Hill companies, but to see the latest products, where the future is going, and what good is all of this if I can't implement all these things? So, you know, I looked at the corporate world, and quite frankly, it wasn't for me. I missed the fight. I missed the struggle. I mean, I grew up a poor barrio kid in L.A., and people helped me get to where I'm at today. And I just felt like something was missing in my life, and what was missing is the action, you know. And some people, most of my friends thought I was nuts to come and take a job like this when I had a, you know, what you most people would term a pretty cushy job. But to me, it's not about cushiness. It's a kind of giving back. And hopefully other people like myself who grew up poor, somebody gave us a chance. And so it's my turn to come back. And I knew the city well since I had been a principal here. And I figured that I think democracy is in jeopardy if public schools aren't successful. And so I guess I'm somewhat of an idealist and wanted to come back and fight for democracy and fight for what we all, you know, this country stands for. And I think the best place to do that is in public education.
This has been something that's come up in the press, and therefore I'm going to have to ask you about it. When you were in Las Vegas, I guess about 7 years ago, you got into some heat using the N-word on the radio, and the African-American community was pretty exercised about it. And so what about ongoing relations with the African-American community? What, from your perspective, actually occurred on the radio?
Well, first of all, that happened after I'd been there like 2 months in Clark County. And what actually happened is that I overheard some kids using the N-word. And so when I start out my discussion, I ask kids what the N-word was, but I use the word. That's probably a mistake I made, and I apologize to anybody for it. But what I actually said was a statement against using the word, not something for it. So I think some people took advantage of that to take it out of context. But obviously, I would never use that term in a derogatory way, and I didn't. And so that happened right when I started there. But I will tell you, if you look at student achievement and you look at what we accomplished there in 5 years, the people who gained the most were African-American and Latino students. So we came a long way, and actually we had a great deal of support of making a difference in those communities, and we did. So I think that, yeah, you know, there are some politics involved there, and unfortunately sometimes people try to manipulate situations.
You've talked about wanting to give back to the community, your commitment to minority students, and your own background coming from the barrio in Los Angeles. What about English as a second language? I believe it's your second language, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I learned English probably around first and second and third grade.
What do we do to immerse students who come from backgrounds where English is their second language to get them simply more fluent and more used to the English language?
Well, first of all, we have to reaffirm that their language is important, and I think that's where we sometimes fail. It doesn't mean, you know, bilingual ed isn't for everybody. I think people have a choice if they want to do that, or if they want to be in a full immersion program, they have a choice to do that. But I do think that one of the things we forget is that knowledge is knowledge, and whether you know something in Russian and Spanish or whatever, or Chinese, that's just as important as if you know it in English. I always joke about how if Albert Einstein came to America at 18 years old, he wouldn't have passed our high school proficiency exam in English, because the written and English portion, he didn't speak. So how could he have passed it? It doesn't mean he wasn't bright. He just couldn't do that. So I think what we need to do is take kids when they arrive and to first build up on the skills that they do have. It's easier to transition a language once you understand your own language. And so I think that obviously our number one priority needs to be to quickly teach kids English as fast as possible, but at the same time, valuing and using some of their language to help them accommodate to switch over to English as quickly as possible. You have to learn English because, you know, in this country, it's very difficult. And since we live in a global economy, I think it's more important that everybody become bilingual. So, you know, under ideal situations, I wish that every single student would graduate from San Francisco Unified completely bilingual, either in Mandarin or in Spanish or maybe Arabic or Indian languages or any language, because I think it helps the thinking process and it makes us more competitive, especially if you read books like The World is Flat, where you realize that if we're not careful as a country in America, we're going to be left behind because the other people have a bigger competitive edge over us because they're hungrier and they speak several languages.
And The World is Flat, we should mention, of course, is Tom Friedman's book, the New York Times columnist. Carlos Garcia with us by phone is superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District. And there's a sense, Superintendent, that attendance is falling away and that is going to be an ongoing problem in the San Francisco schools. Could I ask you to address it?
Yeah, I don't think I've given up on that one. I think if we could start generating some excitement of what it is we do well. For instance, I run into people the other day. I even ran into an anchor person, a television anchor person, who was telling me that their child's ready to go to school and that they were afraid to send them to a school and their neighborhood school where the child's supposed to attend. And I asked him, well, where do you live? And we did a little bit of work, and we actually found out that the school that this person was talking about is one of the top-notch schools that people really want to be at. And so this person just had misinformation. And I have a feeling that, you know, what I'd like to tell the public is, if before you give up on us, why don't you take a little bit of time and come see our schools? You know, make an appointment to come visit the school and look at the school and help us make them better schools. We're open. I'm going to be the first to admit that we have some schools that need improvement. I'm not going to shy about that, and that's how you fix things. I think the public's going to find that I'm very open and very upfront about the problems we have. But the solution to those problems is not to tear down those things, but to, okay, if we have a problem, how are we going to fix it? You know, I almost feel that all of us have, we have whining down to an art form in this country. And if we spent one-tenth of the time we spend complaining about things, fixing things, we'd get a whole heck of a lot done. And so my job here is to come in and fix things. I know we have problems, but that's why I wanted to come here.
Well, you got the contract settled over the weekend. Some think you're a magician for having done that and done it rather swiftly.
Well, I didn't do that alone. There was good negotiating teams on both sides, and we decided to meet halfway. Did some good things for both sides, and it's tough to negotiate when you don't have a lot of money, and that's what made this one tough. But at the same time, I think we did some good things for our schools. 25 of our schools now will be able, some of our lowest, neediest schools will actually be able to hire teachers on an ongoing basis as vacancies occur. And that's important because we're losing our edge to all the competition around the Bay Area when it comes to hiring. We hire people way too late. And so by then, some of the cream of the crop teachers already have jobs. And so we want to do early hiring. And that's a big one for us. And now we're going to be able to do that.
What would you tell the public about, because I know there's concern out there, and you know it as well, about safety and security of schools and preventing violence in the schools? You mentioned before some of the trepidation that people have about the schools in San Francisco. Can you say something reassuring on that score, or is there something that we ought to be reassured about?
Well, I think there's a lot reassuring. I mean, study after study, not only here in San Francisco, but across the country, clearly shows that the safest place in America today, hands down, is in the schools. Do we have problems? Does an occasional fight take place and things like that? Absolutely. Do we sometimes, you know, even heaven forbid, but there are times when we even take guns away from people in America. But for the most part, you know, I think we're doing a lot. The police department works really closely with us. The city is working. The county is working with us. I now meet on a regular basis weekly. I'm part of the mayor's cabinet just so that we know what's going on out there. And I don't have to set up an appointment. I can actually, you know, after the meeting or during the meeting, discuss issues that we need help on. And I think that open dialogue helps to make our schools a lot more successful. We talk with Muni on an ongoing basis. Our biggest fear isn't necessarily what's going on in our schools. I think our schools are very, very safe. Our biggest fear is coming to and leaving school, going back home. Those are things that everybody, the entire community, needs to help us in. And I can honestly say, at least with the type of dialogue we have going, we're all pretty much on the same page.
You're working closer with the mayor, and this has gotten some press attention, kind of a partnership, really, with City Hall. Also, your door is open. I mean, you've said publicly your door is open.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said that because I've had swarms of people. I can honestly say I think I've met with thousands of people since I've been here. But it's been wonderful because everybody has an opinion on education, which is good. And the good thing about that is that it gives me a little bit better of what the big picture is, a better understanding of it. And I've heard a lot of different perspectives. And you know, I always tell people that when I was a principal, I remember when kids would come in and tell me their different perspectives. I even learned this with my own kids, that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. So what I've been working on for the last 6 weeks is finding out where the middle is.
How about your relationship with the board? I was reading Jill Tucker, and she was saying some questions people have about standing up to the board. That seems to be the kind of phrase that rhetorically at least keeps appearing.
Well, I think, you know, the board and I had some really serious conversations before I even got hired. I always tell people I actually volunteered for the job. I didn't need a job. I had a great job that was a very lucrative job, but I really wanted to come here. And so part of the interview, I've even had board members say, well, when we went through the interview process, Carlos even interviewed us. Because I had a lot of questions about you know, it's a small world in education. I had heard their reputation. I had heard the people say things about the board. And so I had honest conversations with them about whether or not they're willing to make a commitment to sometimes set aside their differences to move forward. And I can tell you so far, and granted I'm on the honeymoon period, but so far I think we've really worked as a team. We've set aside sometimes our differences. It's not always going to go the superintendent's way, or it's not always going to go individual board's way, but that's life, and we just have to be able to respectfully disagree at times. And so far, I think we're moving towards that model. And I think having these retreats, you know, we had an earlier retreat. We have one scheduled for this Monday on Labor Day. Those retreats kind of help to develop some understanding of where we're coming from and how we think and the procedures that we're going to follow, where if a disagreement comes up, that we'll be able to respect one another.
Talking with San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Carlos Garcia, and you can join us. And by the way, as the superintendent says, everybody has an opinion on education, so you may want to join us even if you're beyond the boundaries of San Francisco. School started Monday all over the state. Your calls are welcome. You can join us now, 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments for Superintendent Garcia, join us at that number. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. When we return, your calls and emails. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Carlos Garcia, who took over that position in July from Interim Superintendent Gwen Chan. And if you have questions for the superintendent or comments, you are certainly welcome to join us. Our toll-free number available to you, 866-733-6786, or feel free also to send us an email, and our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. And let me go to your calls. Deborah, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The question that I have is, my kids go to a full immersion program at Alice Hung Yu, which is a fantastic school in the city, if not the best one. And I applaud the fact that there are those immersion programs, not only Chinese immersion. And I want to know the vision that he has for the San Francisco School District for the future of immersion programs.
Superintendent.
Sure. Well, I'm a big believer in immersion programs, but I also think that, you know, immersion programs are successful when people have the choice and they make the decision that they want to put their kids in that. So as long as that the demand exists there, then we may have to increase the amount of programs that exist. But it's really a supply and demand issue. I think it's great when communities in most places where we have excellent immersion programs, they happen to be there because the community and the staff really wanted that program there. And so, you know, can we afford to have those in every single place? It's not a question of whether we can afford them. It's of whether or not we can get the staff for all those types of programs. Sometimes we have difficulty finding teachers that are credentialed in specific areas. But as long as, you know, that's why we're trying to develop more partnerships with different groups. We're working with Teach for America. We're working for a lot of different places to try to find more bilingual teachers that can assist us to get more of these types of programs on board.
It brings up the whole question of just what resources there are for programs like immersion programs. I mean, admittedly, like you say, you need people who are committed. You need people who have the kind of educational background that lends itself to helping students who need immersion in language. But there are real budgetary challenges, and the budgetary challenges are tied in simply with the ability to go out and hunt for these people and find them.
Well, that, and also that we can't, you know, sometimes a program might only have 10 people in it. And as much as we would love to run a program for 10 people, we can't afford to run a program for 10 people. And so sometimes you have to take programs like that and make them multi-age, you know, in other words, have a combination class of grades because you're not able to staff it. I mean, financially, how can you do that? And the only concern we've ever had with some of these programs, this is just one example, but there's other programs, is that if we don't have enough children for those programs, can we afford the program? And the answer to that is we have to be very creative. And sometimes we will have to form multi-age classrooms, and sometimes people don't like that. But what other option can we do? Financially, we just can't pull them off.
Let me get more callers on here. Carmen from Sacramento. Good morning. You're on the air. Carmen?
Hello?
Yeah, hi. You're
Hello?
On the air. Good morning, Carmen.
Oh, yes. Good morning. My question for the superintendent is, I'm a teacher in the Sacramento area, and he was talking about these dynamic programs that should be developed at different schools. My question is, what would constitute one of these dynamic programs? What elements need to be in place to make a program a dynamic program in order to attract students?
That's a great question. I think, first of all and foremost, excellent teachers, great teachers who believe in kids and who believe that kids will be successful. I think that you have to have very high standards in the program. In other words, you know, you can't baby kids to poverty. It's great to be compassionate and everything, but every study will show, studies done in ghettos and barrios across America show that kids do better when people have higher expectations and believe that they're smart and believe that they can make it. Then also you have to have pretty dynamic principles. I think the leadership, but studies on effective schools show one common denominator among all effective schools is they have great leaders. And that's something that, you know, we're here in San Francisco, we're starting a leadership training program because as our principals are starting to retire, it's not easy to go out and find good principals. And so we're going to start growing our own. We're working with Berkeley right now on leadership development. We're trying to get Stanford involved right now on some leadership development. We can't do this by ourselves, but we need to start identifying some outstanding principals. And instruction in the programs we have to have in those schools are really great instructional programs. And that means that, see, I firmly believe that our number one priority in in elementary schools and primary schools has to be in the primary grades, first grade through third grade. By the end of third grade, every single child needs to be at reading level. Because every study, all the way from studies where kids were, you know, prisoners in prisons throughout the country, one thing that comes clear is that most kids who didn't read by the end of third grade either dropped out or, they're, you know, 70% of the people in prison are illiterate. So we have to take it upon ourselves to make sure that every elementary school trains its first through third grade teachers to be literacy, you know, reading specialists so they could diagnose what it is that it's going to take to get kids to read. I mean, those are the types of things. Then in the upper grades, I think we shouldn't try to replicate every program at every school. Like high schools try to have the same school at every place. I think you have to think differently. I think you have to have some high schools that might be vo-tech high schools. Yes, I am saying vo-tech. In spite of, you know, No Child Left Behind, I think the pendulum has swung too far to the other direction. I think it's very good to have kids that can be, you know, auto mechanics, that can be mechanics on jet engines and those types of things. We could partner up with the culinary unions. We could partner up with a lot of different, you know, we could have a Cisco certified technicians when they graduate from high school. I think, you know, we have to take a full a different approach of not just, yeah, I think that everybody should have the skills to go to college, and you can provide those in vo-tech programs. But once you get out of high school, you make that decision on whether or not you want to go to college or a vo-tech program, and that's fine.
Superintendent, you brought up this whole question of, well, really how you find the committed and inspiring teachers by saying that you want them in the classroom, wanting them in the classroom, and then finding them, and particularly replacing some of those who have been tenured and who aren't necessarily the kind of teachers that you want in the classroom becomes an enormous and vexing challenge.
Well, I think, you know, business calls it retooling. You know, when an industry gets wiped out and a new industry starts, you kind of retool, you retrain people to be able to do jobs. You know, I guess I haven't given up quite yet on those teachers that you mentioned that maybe are burned out or tired. You know, sometimes we're burned out and tired in education because someone put out our little flame. You know, we had a great idea and somebody came along and said, you know, we're not going to do it. I think what we need to do is kind of re-inspire some of those folks. I think that you know, if we provide good training, effective training, and, you know, like I've always said to people, I've never in my life fired anyone. People fire themselves. You know, you provide as much training and optimism to try to make them successful, and then they make the decision. I think we have some teachers who are outstanding teachers, but the system sometimes doesn't recognize and doesn't reward them enough. So after a while, they start giving up, and we've got to work on making the education, especially teachers, a profession that is honored by society and respected. And that's something that we can't do ourselves, but I think everybody needs to do that. And to be honest with you, I think teachers in America are grossly underpaid.
Before I take some more calls, Superintendent, let me go to some emails. This is from Kurt, who says, wants to know, how many undocumented immigrant students are in our district attending public schools? Can you give the numbers as a percentage?
I couldn't give you a number because, quite frankly, you know, whether people like it or not, if they have an issue with what I'm going to say, they should take it up with the Supreme Court. But the reality, it's illegal for us to ask, you know, whether someone is, you know, documentation. That's not our role in public education. You know, kids are here. Kids didn't make decisions to be here. They're here. And our job is to educate everyone. And I think that beats ignorance anytime.
Of course, this listener, Kurt, also says, don't you find it ironic that when these students graduate, they can't legally work in this country?
Yeah, I do. I think it is a shame. I think that, you know, people graduate from our school systems. I personally believe that they ought to have a chance at the American dream.
Here's another listener who says, why are there so few Spanish language program schools in San Francisco? There seem to be many Cantonese and Mandarin school immersion programs and just language education, but few Spanish, given the importance of the language. We wanted to have our children learn Spanish, found only Cantonese and Mandarin programs had openings, and found little or no diversity in the ethnic makeup of these schools. The current diversity efforts in San Francisco destroy all sense of community. Kids from a local area are dispersed all over the city, and it's virtually impossible to get into your local school. Kids cannot play with their classmates after school because they live on other sides of the city. Do San Francisco schools feel that there is value in community? If so, why have they eliminated it for a diversity program that's not helping close the achievement gap?
Wow, that's a lot of different things, but let me tackle them at once.
Well, it's signed by a San Francisco public school parent, usually.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, first of all, obviously, you know, the immersion programs, you know, we do have a lot of Chinese because there's a demand for people to learn Mandarin. I mean, these programs, people forget they're kind of controlled by demand, okay? So if there's a lot of demand to create a program, as I mentioned earlier, then we're going to look into what we can do to provide that program. So obviously, you know, here in San Francisco, there is a big demand for Mandarin programs. But I will tell you, there's also a huge demand for the Spanish programs. But remember, you know, we offer also bilingual programs. So some kids may not be in the immersion Spanish program, but they might be in a bilingual program. And so, you know, I think we try to provide as many programs as we can. But obviously, you know, could we use more? Absolutely.
But you do have this phenomenon of kids being moved around and not necessarily feeling that coherent community, as the listener says in the email.
Well, because that has a lot to do with how you get admitted into San Francisco Unified. We're trying to be as fair as possible with everybody, so we use a system that kind of randomly places kids, sets some priorities. Papers, you know, people have to come in and fill out some papers, and then it's randomly done through a computer. So, yeah, does everybody get their first choice? No, but it's over like 80% of the people, 90% of the people get one of their first five choices. So it does kind of work, but not, you know, can we satisfy everybody? Absolutely not.
Well, here's a listener who, again, is critical along these lines. Aaron writes, the superintendent mentioned a news anchor who was misinformed about her neighborhood school. It's my understanding that there is no guarantee that our children will be assigned to a neighborhood school. The prospect of shipping my child to the other side of the city is enough to deter me from entering the San Francisco school system. I have a 2-year-old. I'm planning to move away when she turns 4.5. What about resurrecting neighborhood schools?
Well, the diversity index that we use to place kids gives priority to people who live in the neighborhood, okay? So are there some who don't get in? Yeah, there are some, but the vast majority do get in. I think that's a kind of a misnomer out there.
We'll go to more callers. Leah, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a student with Stanford's Teacher Education Program, STEP, a graduate student, and I'm currently, I will be a Spanish teacher, and this spring I will be looking for a job. I live in San Francisco. I actually am a product of San Francisco Public Schools, and I love San Francisco. However, I won't be looking for a job in San Francisco because the entry-level salary for teachers in San Francisco is so much lower than schools on the peninsula that I can't afford to live in San Francisco and work there, although I would prefer it. So my question is, why is it that there's such a salary discrepancy in San Francisco compared to, say, Palo Alto?
Oh, I think that's a really good question. And if you look at what the real discrepancy is in here, the first week I was here, I started to figure out our budget, and I kept saying, something must be missing here. And you're right. It's about $10,000 the difference in salaries in some of the local areas, which is a gross injustice, I think. But what you look at is, if you look at, you know, I was studying Prop 13. And in 1979, when Prop 13 came to be, one of the things that happened is that different counties, a formula was developed on how much of the sale of the property tax goes to each school district by county. And if you look at, since you mentioned San Mateo County, for instance, or Marin County, they actually get over 60 cents per dollar of the property tax that's collected. Whereas here in San Francisco, we get 28% of the property tax. So as you can see, that makes a huge difference. I mean, we'd over double our budget if we were at the, you know, at the 60%. So that's having a huge impact on how we manage this school district. That's one of the reasons for it, and so it makes it difficult. The other thing, we, you know, how we utilize our resources in terms of, you know, not all districts, as you will find, offer lifetime benefits. San Francisco Unified still does, and that does take a big chunk of our money.
What about raising more revenue? I mean, Palo Alto, they do an extraordinary job like they do in other more affluent suburbs like in Marin County and down the peninsula in general. I mean, can San Francisco do better on that score? Does it need to do better on that score? And how
Absolutely. I think, but remember, the district can't generate revenue necessarily, okay? The revenue comes through the county and city and the state. What we can do, and there is some...
I'm talking about going out with your cup in hand, so to speak, to parents within the district, which is what a lot of people do in Palo Alto and places like that.
I think if you look at socioeconomically, you know, we can do that more, and we do need to do that more with the business community here. But socioeconomically, contrary to what everybody thinks, we're not an affluent district in terms of our student population, okay? We may, and our voters here have been quite generous. You know, they passed a Proposition A to rebuild our schools. They recently passed Proposition H to tax themselves, actually to go ahead and provide arts and sports and different things to our schools. And in fact, at our press conference just the other day, on Monday, when we talked about negotiations, there's talk right now with a lot of people talking about having a parcel tax where the most of the money would be going directly to teacher salaries. So there is that kind of conversation going on.
Talking with Carlos Garcia, who is superintendent of San Francisco's Unified School District, and joining us from San Francisco, Michael, good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, Michael. How you doing? Spoke to you many times. Great program. I just wanted to say that I've had my son in what's considered a very affluent school and in San Francisco, French American International School, and I'm certainly not on the upper income scale. I'm a taxi driver, and I worked very hard to have him in this school because I believe that the public schools don't offer a viable alternative to children as far as their future in the world is concerned. And the world is shrinking rapidly, and I believe that in order for them to have a broader scope of the world, it's absolutely crucial that every child in America is introduced to language from primary levels all the way through high school, which lets them see through language, culture, and a larger view of the world. And I just don't buy the excuse that it's a matter of demand. If there's a matter of demand, it's because people have had other choices to make, and they're willing to pay for those choices and sacrifice for those choices. And I think a lot of parents aren't willing to do that. They'd rather spend their money on fancy cars and on big houses than on their children. I think that's where it all begins.
Well, Michael, you're not thank you for the call. I guess he's not accepting what you're saying here, Superintendent, which is you're trying to make these schools more global economy-minded, public schools in San Francisco, and certainly reaching out to extend beyond this monolingual kind of straitjacket that so many kids grow up in America.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, the reality is that, you know, we want to grow those programs, and I think if you compare to where they've been, in fact, there's a task force right now that is actually working on where we're going to go with all these programs. You know, what I like to tell the public is, you know, I'll be very honest with you, I don't think I've solved all the problems in the 6 weeks that I've been here, okay? And I'd be the first to admit that they're going to take years to solve some of these problems. But
it's a major public admission.
But they are on our radar screen. And that's something that, you know, why we're going on a retreat with the board is we're going to prioritize. You know, we want to have like three or five priorities where we can't take a shotgun approach to fix everything. But if we concentrate on what it is that we want to do and make sure that we do that well before we move on, then we have to have a brand new strategic plan. Just like, you know, the advantage I have is that I was in the business sector for 2 years after being in the public sector for 30 years. One thing I've learned there is that, you know, return of investment. And one of the things that we have to look at the school district is what is our return for investment? If we want to be good stewards and have the taxpayers support us, then we need to show outcomes to them. We need to show, okay, if you're going to trust your tax dollars to us, this is what you're going to get in return. And what we're going to lay out is a strategic plan that clearly demonstrates and holds us accountable to show the taxpayer how we utilize the resources. If we have programs that are immersion programs, what results are we getting from them? You know, how much language are kids learning? If we're going to test kids in English, and if they're in immersion programs, then we have to test them in the language that they're immersed in as well so that we can see if those programs are good. One of the things that I think that's been sorely lacking here is accountability in terms of evaluating all our programs. You know, we have over 350 CBOs. You know, those are community-based organizations that help us here in San Francisco. They're a great assistance to us, but the only question I have, and I have asked them all, we're going to create an evaluation instrument to see their effectiveness. How do all of these support our educational mission in education? So those are the types of conversations that we need to lay out and be honest about them and lay out a plan of how we're going to address these issues.
And there were people who expected you to solve every problem in 6 weeks, huh?
Well, I don't want to run out of work.
Let me get some more callers on here. Sarah joining us. Morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, this is Sarah. I'm a public school teacher at one of the highly desired immersion programs. And I appreciate you guys talking about immersion because I think it is a unique and valued part of our public education system. But it seems like from the inside that our programs don't feel sustainable. Every year we're being asked to do more with less resources. We no longer have paraprofessionals. We've lost our tutoring programs, our after-school programs, our school counselors. I'm just wondering what support you can give to us teachers to be able to do our job and to achieve the test scores with the resources that we need.
Well, that's the difficulty about this job, and it's the difficulty about our budget. I will tell you, I came here, and I've had lots of experience working with districts. This is my fourth superintendency, and I have to tell you, this budget is one of the worst I've ever seen. And so we have a lot of work to do with this budget to make it something that we could do a lot of things with, because, you know, it's a good example. Yeah, we settled negotiations, but at what price? You know, we've cut everything. You know, we've asked schools to do a 2% cut. We've asked district office to do a 5% cut. Pretty soon we have nothing left to cut. And so I recognize that people are out in the sites are reducing things only because we've been in this mode that in order to survive, we think that the best way to do it is to cut. And I don't see that as a solution. I'm actually bringing what they call a FICMAC team, a state independent team that's going to review the budgets here in San Francisco Unified, because I have concerns about them and I want to be able to have a third party substantiate where it is we are financially and what are some measures we can do to assure that we're maximizing our resources.
And I want to thank Sarah for her call and go to a couple of your emails. Some very pointed questions here in emails that really get to the heart of, I think, concerns that are out there. This is from a listener who says, I'm a prospective parent and I'm trying to educate myself on the San Francisco Unified District, the schools, how the system works, etc. What do you recommend we do to best familiarize ourselves with the system? Also, my husband and I would like to stay in San Francisco, but we're not confident our kids-to-be will get a good education in the public system. Is there anything you can say to convince us otherwise?
Yeah, I think, people forget this, whether it's parochial schools, public schools, but people forget, if you take the top 20% of the kids in American public schools, they basically outperform anybody. They really do. What people forget in America is that we're trying to educate everybody. I mean, we give everybody an opportunity, which is why it's so critical to have a good public school system. If I suggest this parent to go and visit schools, now set up, we have a volunteer bureau. You can even contact them. They will make arrangements to help you to go see what's going on in schools. Get involved in schools that you might be interested, even if your kids aren't of that age yet, so that you kind of get a feel of what's going on. I think people would be surprised of all the really good things that are going on. Now, having said that, are there still schools that need a lot of work? You bet there is. You know, I'd say there's about 50% of our schools that still require a lot of work. And those are the things that we're going to try to maximize our resources, concentrate on, and to create an atmosphere here that those schools, you know, if a school isn't being successful, that has to be unacceptable, because any school has to be good enough for anybody's child and not just for some children. So we've got some work cut out, and that's what we're going to be doing. But don't give up on us yet until you give us the proof is in the pudding. Go at least taste it and see what it looks like.
Talking again with Carlos Garcia, Superintendent of San Francisco Unified, and here are a couple of related emails, Superintendent. Miriam writes, I'm a Latina, have a master's degree in humanities, a B.S. in mathematics, speak, read, write fluent Spanish and English. I live in San Francisco. I've always wanted to be a teacher, but I've shied away from it due to the low salaries. How do you encourage people like myself to make a career change from the private sector to education? And how can teachers who live in San Francisco afford living here, especially if they're single? And then I've got this listener named Gabrielle who writes, I recently read that New York City has a program specifically targeted toward recruiting mid-career professionals to teach. It includes support for the education required to obtain a teaching credential. Does San Francisco have or is it contemplating anything similar? I'm inspired by Dr. Garcia's vision. I'm ready to leave my law job to work for the school system.
Well, come on down. We need you.
She sends her contact information, by the way, which we can pass on to you. But we're really talking in a generic way about people who want to make that shift and who are afraid to because of salary or because they don't have the credential. Programs and ways of kind of facilitating that.
If you email the school district, there are credential programs to even help people who are working to get a credential. And remember that all those requirements are not set up by the district. They're actually set up by the state, okay? So sometimes people yell at us for, but we didn't create those. The state does. So, but we do have partnerships with different colleges here that help people who are working come on, get into our system. Now, I do want to address the fact that, you know, let me tell you, nobody goes into education because they're going to be wealthy, unfortunately. I mentioned before, I think that I believe that, you know, teachers ought to be making $100,000 a year because it's a very difficult job. And I guess what frustrates me is that here in America, we always say, you know, everybody seems, anybody who runs for office always says they're the education this and education that. But we don't really walk the talk because the reality is the proof is in what's happening. If you want to draw the best, you know, when Sputnik went up, we made a decision in this country that we were going to put all our resources to get to the moon, and we did. You know, we built, with the Marshall Act, we went out and built, Europe, rebuilt it after the war, and rebuilt Japan as well. You know, where's the Marshall Act to rebuild America and America's schools? You know, if public education is the most important and educating our future is the most important thing, and I believe it is, then why don't we stop all the lip service and start putting the resources to bring good salaries to teachers so that we can attract mathematicians, scientists, so we could be competitive, so we could draw the best people possible to be there teaching our children. And, you know, I'm sorry, you know, I don't have to be politically correct because the good thing about being a superintendent is that I don't work for adults. I work for children.
On that note, Superintendent, thank you so much for joining us. Carlos Garcia, again, a superintendent of San Francisco's Unified School District. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We're going to take another direct look at education in a different dimension in the hour coming up. We're going to talk about preschool education and have a debate, really, about whether or not it ought to be universal, among other debates going on between a couple of dueling academics. David Kirp and Bruce Filler will both be joining us, and I hope you'll join us for that. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our production assistants are Tina Lauerberg and Sarah Skickney. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.